Welcome to Nell and Matt's Obsolete Movies, the podcast where we revisit movies from our 20-plus years of collecting films in obsolete formats. Another way of thinking about it is this is a podcast about films from the VHS era, though we don't necessarily watch them all on VHS. And a good example of that is today's podcast. Our film for this episode is The Haunting of Sarah Hardy, which first aired on the USA Network May 31st, 1989. And we have it on Laserdisc, getting it, well, earlier this summer from Assumption Records in Riseville, West Virginia, a little town just south of Morgantown. And Assumption Records is a really cool record store inside an old church. And they just happen to have some Laserdiscs that they got in. And we got first crack at the pile, and this is the first of probably quite a few podcasts from that pile. And of course, we chose this movie. Well, I chose this movie, and I'm not really sure why.
Instead of Disney, we skipped over all the Disney that they had, and
which are probably worth something to collectors. We're like, we don't want those. We want a bad late '80s made-for-TV movie.
Well, you know, anything that smacks of horror, I tend to pick up because I am a huge horror
fan. Oh, that's right.
Fan.
You picked this out of the pile. So I picked it from our pile. So this is a comedy of errors.
So I saw Haunting in the title and assumed there might be some
And there's
scares.
A big old picture of a cemetery with mist in it on the back cover. So
you would make assumptions, right? You're thinking this is going to be scary.
Mist, and there's a gothic-y hooded figure with no face in front of an old spooky mansion. And
well, there you go.
Yeah, so this is horror. But not horror, but anyway.
So this comes from the 1980s when these made-for-TV movies were huge. And, you know, back in the 80s, you didn't necessarily have VHS or any other VCRs.
Well, VCRs was... I mean, my family's first VCR was on layaway. We talked about this during the... during the Moonstruck podcast.
So there was excitement for made-for-TV movies because if you couldn't get to the movie theater, you had to wait a very, very, very long time for something to come to TBS or...
And that's if you had basic cable. I mean, that's the other thing is thinking about what it means to even have like 40 channels to choose from, let alone, I mean, in my childhood... Granted, growing up in New York City, we had some UHF stations. But you still only had maybe 5 or 6 viable TV stations, and then that bumped up to the magic number of like 40. And certainly the USA Network was one of those where you're like, ooh, you know. And so this idea...
And the USA Network was like the little bit edgier ones because it was USA. And so they were trying to, to make their brand... but this, so, you know, at the time, Farrah Fawcett ruled these made-for-TV movies. So she had The Burning Bed, Small Sacrifices, Extremities. So she really ruled made-for-TV movies when they were really popular. And, of course, there was the famous miniseries, like Thornbirds, that were happening at this particular time.
Yeah, and I think it's something that is hard to remember... For people our age, and I think for younger folks, it's difficult to fathom the idea of consuming entertainment that was merely because it was one of the handful of things that was available.
You had no choice.
You had very few choices, and this idea of maybe hyper algorithmically selected to you, I'm going to stream this one thing that's in this genre of things that I really, really like, and this is going to be perfect for me. Kind of wasn't how the world worked, even with basic cable, even with, you know, the early days of owning a VCR.
When you had HBO and Prism, it was whatever they could get for the cheapest amount of money is what they showed.
Yes.
Which is why Beastmaster is a cult favorite, because it was cheap.
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
And being the youngest in the family, for prime time watching, I didn't have really much choice. I waited till late night when everyone was sleeping.
How many TVs did your families have?
We actually had two at the time. One in downstairs and one in upstairs.
Okay.
But, you know, you weren't supposed to watch TV unsupervised. But, you had very limited choice. You had to kind of go with whatever everybody else was watching. I vaguely remember this movie, and I might have talked my sisters into watching it because it seemed vaguely scary.
Mm-hmm.
And as a young horror fan who grew up in a Catholic house, trying to get to see a horror film was really difficult. I was actually probably like in my late teens before I saw The Exorcist.
Wow.
Because of that.
Yeah, which I think we're saying this also because a movie like The Haunting of Sarah Hardy, I think could only be possible under these circumstances, or that folks like us would see it. I mean, you know, part of the hyper algorithmically or whatever, or hyper test marketed thing for Entertainment Now, this is also a proto Lifetime movie. So I guess we should explain the plot of this proto Lifetime movie. You have a protagonist, Sarah Hardy. The movie begins very dramatically in the past, I think 12 years prior. She's a little girl. Her dad has just died. Her mom is like, "Say you wish it was me," or something, and then walks into the sea. And, you know, she's obviously then psychologically damaged and ruined forever in this, like, bad psych 101 class understanding of psychology.
We should also mention that before her mom runs to the ocean, the little girl asks the maid if her mom's going back to the asylum.
Mentions
that because mom has this freak out moment and breaks the little girl's photo and says, your father loved you more than me, and all this other stuff. So there's this traumatizing moment in her life where she witnesses her mom run into the ocean.
Yes, and of course this is also like light beer gothic. You know, the gothic equivalent of light beer, you know. Goes watered down, goes down easy. There's this huge estate called the Pines where this happens. That's right on the coast, you know. And so then suddenly we jump into the present day. It's 12 years into the future then, and she's getting married now. Sarah Hardy is getting married, and she has decided now that she's married, she's going to move back to the big house. Because what better way to start a new life with a new husband and a new chapter than going back to the seat of your personal, emotional, family trauma and just trying to live with that every day. It's just the best idea.
We should also mention that she has her two best friends who were there at the funeral and also at her wedding. So Alan and Morgan Fairchild as Lucy.
Yes. And so they get married. There's the house. We meet the busybody housekeeper who's like straight out of Central Casting. And then that's when the spooky stuff starts. That's when you have the haunted harpsichord and intrigue, right? She hears voices coming through the ductwork. There's, you know, misty nights on the seaside, which again, I mean, that gothic visual language of liminal spaces, of potentially spooky, of being haunted by history, especially inherited family history.
Mm-hmm.
It's all there in this movie.
Yeah. And she keeps seeing a figure that was dressed like her mom when her mom killed herself. But also, bum, 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 they never found mom's body.
Yes.
So that's also supposed to be
part of the plot. Part of the plot. And so, again, in true gothic light beer stylings, is mom's alive in the house and haunting her daughter? Or is it a ghost? Or is it, in the case of this film, her husband is... Sorry, spoilers, but you don't want to watch this anyway. And you might not even be able to watch this movie anyway. Her husband's having an affair, and they're trying to drive her to commit suicide like her mom, and so that her husband and her best friend could live happily ever after with Sarah Hardy's money.
It's also like, it seems like the plot of a Vincent Price movie.
Yes.
But I would say in terms of like watered down beer or Miller Lite, it does feel like a play on Diabolique.
Yeah.
A little bit.
Yeah.
Except some of the role reversing happening, but...
Yeah, which now you're talking me into thinking about this movie as more... I'm talking myself into this, too. Thinking about this movie as more interesting than it actually is, but in a very weird way. I mean, much like, I guess, romance novels and fantasy novels, a lot of pulp fiction, there's a formula. There is already a discourse, visual language, if you want to call it that, conventions, allusions you could make. And so there's a really strong playbook for this type of story, and you just got to execute those elements.
I was thinking about, like, Russian formalism as we were watching it. It was almost Yeah, in the sense of, like, you must have the woman in peril, check. You must have fog, check. Like, this very prescribed...
You must have a big, scary old house, check.
You must have a secret, because she doesn't tell her new husband about her mom killing herself.
Family secret, check. By the seaside, helps, check.
Check, yeah.
Busybody housekeeper, check.
Yeah.
Yeah. And also in the way, like a good 80s TV movie, there's the illusion of sex, or there is, like, sex light in it. Basic cable, you still couldn't show a lot of things. But so there is a sexiness to it. There's a fabulousness to it. There is, you know, characters who are of an elevated station in life as well. So, I mean, there is wealth and all of that in play. Again, all of that visual language.
And
there's the light Hitchcockian memory elements. I was also thinking... This is an era when people thought Brian De Palma was a really, really prestigious and good filmmaker.
Oh my gosh, that is so true. There is definitely a tinge of Brian De Palma
in this.
The funny thing, though, because it's an 80s made-for-TV movie, it's also very bright. And
yes.
Everybody always looks their best.
Which, when you get to... And once Joel Siegel said this in a movie review... you can't unsee it. The thing about made-for-TV movies, everybody's hair... The lighting is too bright.
Yes.
Everybody's hair is always perfect. Everybody's clothes are always perfectly pressed. And once you hear that, you can't unsee it when watching these kinds of films. And so, yeah, even the scene, it's post-coital. She's been sleeping for several hours.
Yeah.
And she hears the haunted harpsichord and voices. And she comes down the grand staircase. Her hair is perfect, her makeup is perfect, and her nightgown does not have a wrinkle in it.
There's also a scene later when the husband obviously had just had sex with Morgan Fairchild. They were sleeping for a few hours. And the way Morgan Fairchild is supposedly sleeping, you can tell they're like, okay, that's the best side for lighting. There's no drool.
Yes.
Her hair is still perfectly coiffed. Not even smushed by the pillow because of the way she's positioned. Her hair is still looking gorgeous. And that all happens. But so what ends up happening is that her new husband and her best friend Lucy, played by Morgan Fairchild, try to scare her. So Morgan Fairchild is dressing up like mom and running around and doing the voices. And so the night that Sarah threatens to leave her husband because she just had a miscarriage, supposedly had a miscarriage, he panics and they decide to, you know, kill her that night. And she ends up running off into the night with her bottle of pills. They find the bottle of pills by the ocean. They assume that she's drowned herself. There's no evidence of a body. And what ends up happening is that she didn't kill herself. She became suspicious of her husband and Lucy. And so she ran off into the night. And she starts breaking into the house to try to find information, and they think it's her ghost coming back to get them.
Yes.
It is such a contrived plot.
It's a contrived plot.
With a twist at the end.
With a twist at the end that doesn't make any sense.
No.
Yeah.
It's bad.
It's bad. It's weird. Bad. It's also something that was... profoundly normal at a time in our lives.
Yeah.
And so when it comes to thinking about revisiting this movie in the 2020s, I found myself thinking about bad elementary school cafeteria Pizza Fridays. And that it wasn't good pizza. It wasn't fantastic. And it was not, you know, there wasn't even a lot of cheese on it.
Yeah.
It was a giant, thick, you know, compressed cardboard crust with a thin layer of tomato sauce and a smattering of shredded mozzarella cheese. But yet, you know, bad high school, bad elementary school cafeteria pizza in the 80s. Come on, don't you miss it a little bit? And I found that this was a time travel experience watching this movie in the 2020s.
Yeah, and to use your analogy of the cafeteria pizza, it didn't have to be good because it was the only choice, right?
Yes.
And that's the same thing with 80s made-for-TV movies and miniseries. They didn't necessarily have to be good because you're going to watch anyway because there was limited competition.
Yeah.
I look at today like The Mandalorian and Loki, which you hear all this buzz about, and everyone's talking about the acting and direction.
And the production
and
values.
And the production values. Back in the 80s, they're like, they'll watch it anyway, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it was almost like, you know, people have called this the golden age of television. And it's like almost television had to be destroyed in order for the golden age of television to happen.
Yeah. And there's also these kind of interesting people in that, like, so Cella Ward, who, you know, when she came on the screen, I was like, oh, I recognize that face. And she's just kind of a person who was in and out of, like, TV series throughout the 80s and 90s, I think even into the 2000s. She, I think her biggest thing was that she played the wife in The Fugitive with Harrison Ford. And then we were talking about Morgan Fairchild, and we're like, why is Morgan Fairchild famous? Like, I don't even know why. She just kind of did a bunch of TV series and commercials. She just happened to be everywhere. And usually if she shows up in the movie, she's the vixen or she's the bad guy. So immediately when we saw Lucy, I was like, oh, Morgan Fairchild, she's probably doing something bad and plotting. So you kind of already knew because that's the archetype that she typically plays. And so thinking about this, these like people would not really have careers today because like
or maybe something very different would be demanded of them.
Yeah, that's true.
By the entertainment industry. Again, if you have very few choices, if it sells advertising, if also maybe again, this was the era people thought Brian De Palma, people thought a movie like Dressed to Kill was high art. In his own, like, Miller Lite beer version of, or Coors Light beer version of Alfred Hitchcock. You know, people just were not as sophisticated as viewers. This idea of also something that maybe wasn't, though we're talking about this being on Laserdisc, something that maybe wasn't even meant for multiple viewings.
Yeah.
You know, you can just crank it out and go make another one.
Yeah.
And crank it out and go make another one. And that's fine. Whereas now, when I say about, you know, in order for the golden age of television to happen, television has to be destroyed.
Yeah.
You know, the era of streaming, the era of, you know, if you want to watch your favorite movie at 3 in the morning or at 10 a.m., you just can. And you don't even have to necessarily leave your house if it's available on streaming or if you pirate it. That maybe demands very different things from your audience.
Yeah, I mean,
and your producers
right.
of culture.
Right. And I guess if you're hoping for a couple, like, eerie moments in this, and that's it, it kind of delivers on that, not strongly, but you wouldn't necessarily go back and revisit this film because you'll know, you know the whole
You
plot.
Know the twist.
You know the twist.
And it's not even, like, something like Sixth Sense or The Usual Suspects, where, like, you can watch it a second time to see how you're being set up.
Right.
Which I know a lot of people did.
Yeah.
One of the other reviews, actually, to loop back to initial critical reception for a moment, one of the reviews at the time said that at least, you know, it was sort of a horror movie or a gothic-y movie that didn't have violence and gore in it.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, which is actually interesting. Our podcast before this was, of course, Friday the 13th, the slasher, not slasher quite yet movie, or the Jason movie that's not really a Friday the 13th Jason movie, but it's called Friday the 13th. That this was also maybe in the context where Yeah, I mean, gore, practical effects, slashers. If you wanted scary, that had really taken over by 1989, and maybe there wasn't a whole lot else you could do. And there's also, like, would have been limits to what if those movies would make it to television.
That's true.
You know, so I think we also have to think about this film as belonging to that moment, too, where it's like, well, yes, if we want something a little spooky, but yet there's no blood in it. Even the deaths are bloodless.
Yeah.
You know, and even the fake deaths are bloodless. But yet to still have those era, you know, moments or these illusions of hauntings and ghosts and echoey voices and the harpsichord that plays itself or whatever. That yeah. This is also maybe would have been, hey, this is what you got. You know, we didn't have slow burn, spooky, atmospheric horror
yeah.
in the late 80s either.
The other funny thing about it is that I wonder if it actually would have been better as a miniseries, because there's also, they try to pack a lot into it, and so there's loose ends.
It's a very busy plot.
So there's loose ends to it, like the maid, Sarah suspects that the maid is actually trying to dress up as her mom to scare her out of the house, and she fires the maid. And when Sarah disappears, the maid threatens the new husband, saying, I know what happened. And nothing happens with that. Like, there's no big...
It is a plot dead end.
It's a plot dead end. There's no big confrontation. There's no him trying to kill her. You just... Like, there... You know, or even that Sarah was plotting with her to make that call, so the husband got spooked. So you kind of have these weird plot ends, plot holes. And then, like, you have this, like, aunt and uncle who you assume raised her, you see, like, twice, and you're like, who are these people?
Yeah.
So you don't actually really find out what happens to Sarah between when her mom killed herself and when she's getting married, right? And so, and there's actually really no backstory of mom. Like, what was wrong with mom? Was she schizophrenic? You know, she actually goes to the asylum while her mom was a patient, but doesn't find out any information, right? So it's kind of very bizarre.
It's bizarre. It's busy. It's, you know, to go back to a comment I made earlier in the podcast, yeah, the thing about formula fiction, genre fiction, pulp fiction, if you want to, whatever phrase you want to use to describe it, there's a playbook, there's a visual language, and you can execute that play. And it just... This film tries to jam into 90 minutes, because it's got to be 90 minutes for a two-hour film. You got to be able to sell 30 minutes worth of commercials to make that money back. I'm sorry, 28 minutes worth of commercials. It's a 92-minute film. They just run a lot of plays. I mean, and you think, again, is it smarter? I mean, there's elements, I think, of Charlotte Perkins Gilman's The Yellow Wallpaper in here. Mm. There are, you're right, elements of Vincent Price. I mean, I think even just the whole Gothic literature canon, you know, is there elements of Poe in this?
Yeah.
You know, the idea of haunting and inheritance straight out of, you know, some 19th century fiction is in there. To make this movie that, again, is a square cut of 80s elementary school half cafeteria pizza. But hey, it's Friday and the chocolate milk is flowing freely, so what can you say about this film?
And it's interesting, too, because the, you know... You have definitely seen the shift of people who would be considered big screen actors willing to do good miniseries. And so that kind of shift has happened. Even in Iron Man, like, you have an amazing lead actor in Iron Man who was willing to do that. So I think there's been this shift of what's considered prestige and what actors are used to. The other thing about made-for-TV movies is often the caliber of actor you could get was not great. I mean, I think War and Remembrance and Winds of War got Robert Mitchum, but he was, let's be honest, at the end of his career. He really wasn't getting anything. So they actually have Polly Bergen, who was in this film. And so she actually did... Polly Bergen... did Cape Fear. So she was in the original Cape Fear and had a pretty good career. And she actually did one of my favorite movies called Move Over Darling, which was just a great, great, when AMC showed old films, a great film back in the day. And she actually also did War and Remembrance and Winds of War. So she this is a big part of these miniseries that happen. But my, of course, my favorite role for her was Crybaby, where she played Johnny Depp's character's aunt in that.
Fantastic.
So they got one kind of legit actress to play in it. So the caliber of acting that you get is also not that great. And so I found it hard to kind of connect with Sarah Harding. I didn't really feel for her.
Yeah, I mean, I think the characters don't develop. They don't do anything. They don't go anywhere.
Yeah.
Stuff happens to them.
Yeah.
And then it stops happening when the movie's over. And actually, the movie does end in a cliffhanger.
It does end in a cliffhanger, but not a
an illogical cliffhanger.
Yeah.
But.
Absolutely.
A cliffhanger nonetheless. And the credits roll, and we're out.
Yeah.
Which I think maybe means it's a good time, yes, to think about the big four, the four big questions. The four big questions. The first one is it camp retro classic, or is it just an old movie?
I guess it's just an old movie.
It is just an old movie. But, you know, it's an experience, and I think you can only... unless you're the biggest Lifetime Movie Network fan in the world. Because, again, this is a proto... That I mean, if punk, you know, MC... It's like what punk is... What MC5 was to punk, The Haunting of Sarah Hardy is to the Lifetime Movie Network. You know, it's the MC5 of Lifetime movies, maybe. This is one way of thinking about it. I can only experience this movie as a historical artifact.
Yeah.
Which is okay to have as an experience, I guess. But that we bought better DVDs from Assumption. Blu-rays. Laserdiscs.
Yeah, I think it's definitely...
Laserdiscs.
Just an old movie. But I do think if you're interested in like cultural studies and of what's happening at the time, it is a good example of how...
And the car casting is incredible.
Not
to be overly hyperly masculine, but
is pretty accurate.
There is even a Citroën DS.
Yes. And actually...
Citroën SM.
In terms of costuming, too, like there's a scene where she has the sweater tied across her shoulders, very 80s, typical 80s look.
Yeah.
So if you want to see, like, oh, this is what 80s were like, that was absolutely
yes.
it.
And what we did on Friday and Saturday nights.
In the 80s.
Because that's what you had. What about the social political distance of the film? Question two.
Well, of course there's no diversity in the film.
There is no diversity.
At all. It is wealthy white people having wealthy white people problems.
It is an empowered female character. Mm. She doesn't lay down and die. She doesn't, after she's being gaslit, just crumble and appease her husband.
Yeah.
She attempts to take control of the situation.
Yeah, and she does actually, when they think that she killed herself, she does start putting the pieces of the puzzle together and realizes that she's in danger and she leaves. So there's not actually a big fight scene where she's trying to fend off her husband from slashing her wrist or something like that. That seemed like his intention that he was going to do that. She actually kind of figured out the pieces and escaped on her own and realized that she definitely was in danger. So there's definitely some of that. And I will even say her relationship with Lucy... A lot of their discussions do kind of focus on her history and what she's struggling with. And though they do talk about her husband, it's in terms of, is he ready to accept her big secret?
Yeah.
So it's, you know, it's not a lot of 80s movies, you know, especially romantic comedies. It's all about, how do I get the guy? And that definitely, those conversations don't happen. And even Lucy has her own career and, you know, is a failing actress, but still obviously had her own career.
And was making her own money, though she had.
Yeah.
You know.
And then she does, to some extent, try to save herself. There is a scene where Alan, her childhood friend, shows up with the police just in time.
Yes.
But
who's also a psychologist.
Who's also a psychologist.
Who they're obviously also romantically inclined towards one another, which is super unethical. But again, to get the psychological element in here, you have a psychologist who...
So I guess in terms of 80s movies, especially, well, let's just be honest, a lot of the 80s movies were about women in peril and women being beaten or in bad relationships or whatever. So, I mean, it's certainly like a bad relationship situation, but she kind of uses her smarts to get out of it, and
yes,
she is trying to figure out how to manage this situation. She doesn't feel as victimized as a lot of women in 80s made-for-TV movies were.
Yes. Question three, what about our, you know, technical distance from the film?
So the most notable one, and it's also a big plot point, is like the phone. It has like lights up on it, and which cracked me up when you saw that.
Yes,
phone.
The multi-line. Those people were important. They had more than one extension on their phone line.
Yeah, which was so funny. And so she does like pick up the phone at one point and listen into a conversation.
Yes.
So at that time it would have been a sign of wealth that if you had a house that had multiple phone lines and you had a phone,
you were important,
that had the buttons that allowed you to switch to the different phone lines. That cracked me up because that was definitely a sign of wealth at that
That's
time.
That's true.
And definitely not a sign of wealth anymore.
I was thinking about canceled and returned checks.
Yes.
As well. It
yes.
was a really important plot point in the film. I think for me, though, the biggest technical distance, is in the production.
Yeah.
I will say the other thing is the music does a lot of work in terms of the spookiness. You can't get away with it. It's mixed very high as well. But it sounds like 80s music. 80s, cheesy 80s, super clean production in a gothy setting. And again, the fact that just everybody's hair is way too nice. Everybody's fashion game is always on point.
Yes.
Even when they're in peril, even when they're asleep.
Yeah.
And the lighting is always too bright and too perfect.
Yeah.
It's a made-for-TV film.
And the husband had one of those 80s sweaters. I think we all know that 80s
sweater. The Cosby sweater, yeah.
It's very, you know, so there's definitely those things do come out.
Yes. So finally, question four of the four big. Is this Laserdisc a keeper?
No.
No.
No, I'll never watch this again.
What if, though, in another 20 years, we are nostalgic for late 80s? I mean, that, again, maybe it's like, remember in the 80s when we watched bad TV movies because there was nothing on and we have 9 million selections now on the internet to stream from?
Well, just to let you know, the director who just did a lot of these made-for-TV movies, I actually grabbed his other one, which is Child of Light, Child of Dark. So we actually do have yet another one of these type of films that we
watch.
So we have some variety now.
And maybe in a few months we might bust that one out for another episode. But on that note, I think we're good. I think we're out. I think we've talked about this movie.
It's definitely
more
not
than it should deserve, have any right to be talked about.
On Rotten Tomatoes, it hasn't even been reviewed. Don't even watch it. It's not worth it. It's bad.
Unless you miss the bad high school or elementary school cafeteria pizza you ate in the 80s. Hey, have some fun. Or if you do want to bond with someone, ironically, over Lifetime movies.
Yeah, okay. All right. Bye, everyone.
Bye.